Welcome to Between the Margins, a show about human rights and people's pursuit of happily ever after on CHRW 94.9 FM. My name is Michelle Boyce, and we are talking about a show today on a topic that I wish we would never have to talk about anywhere in the world. But unfortunately, in 33 states and 56 countries in the world, they still have the death penalty. And we are murdering people and teaching our kids that murder is okay. And I'm not okay about that. But in a new Angus Reid poll just put out last week, the Canadian citizens have declared that 64% of them are in favor of bringing back the death penalty. So today's show is all about that issue. We have three fantastic guests on the air with you today. We have the husband of a death row inmate. We have the sister of a death row inmate who there is good chance that her brother is not guilty of the crime, but he has been sitting in a cell for 20 years for that crime and is fighting for his very life. So, and we have Tracy, who is an absolute gem. She is a Canadian. Her and her now husband, Dave, have founded an agency here in Canada that is doing death penalty advocacy work around the world. And I caught up with Tracy, and here's her opinions.
My name is Tracy Lamori. Among many other things I do, I'm a co-founder and director of the Canadian Coalition for the Death Penalty, which we founded. I founded along with Dave Parkinson in 1998.
So in 1998, you founded this institution, and Canada hasn't had the death penalty in a very long time. So why do a couple of Canadians found a death penalty advocacy group?
Well, essentially, the answer to that question is, you know how they say if there's a book you want to read, and it's not written, then you should write it. We had grown disturbed about what we were reading in the early days of the internet, actually. And we'd always been activists, anti-racist activists, anti-poverty activists, several different, areas. And we were actually looking for some links connected to those issues to make a very, very early web page, just, as advocates of the things that we do. And we got along some information originally about the case of Jimmy Dennis, who we've been working with that for years and years, innocent on death row in Pennsylvania. But through our study of that, just sort of accidentally brought to our attention, through our study of that, we started looking at the death penalty in general in the states, and it seemed like a combination of all of that work, the anti-poverty work we had done, the anti-racist work we had done, because so many of those issues actually culminate in the issue of the death penalty, which people don't realize, and then we kill the people, So it was disturbing to us, and we looked for a Canadian group that might be working, because there are a lot of European groups, they haven't had the death penalty in Europe, for equally as long as in Canada, but in Europe they're very, very strong advocates. They absolutely see it as a human rights abuse, not just as a criminal justice issue, as we tend to see it in North America. And so there are very strong European voices against the death penalty, and we were looking for something of this sort in Canada, just because being such close neighbors to the United States and so similar, unfortunately, in so many ways, we felt that it was sort of incumbent upon Canada to have a voice. Couldn't find that voice, other than, small amnesty chapters dealing with it, among other things. So we decided to become that voice. And even though we ourselves thought, gee, how much of a necessity will this be, it turned out very quickly that we learned how much it was. I mean, our Canadian citizen, Stan Falder, was executed in 1999, the year after we formed. As a result, before that happened, we tried to save his life with a boycott of Texas that made international news, including front page news in Texas. We've had a couple of Canadians. Right now we have a Canadian citizen on death row in Montana at very serious risk of execution. Harper, for example, has completely abdicated his responsibility and our Canadian tradition of speaking out for our prisoners in that case. So, there's been a lot of reasons for us to actually speak out for Canadians, including there's a Canadian on death row at risk of being beheaded in Saudi Arabia several years ago. He's since been repatriated and freed. But yes, there's been a lot of occasions where Canadians were at risk of the death penalty abroad that we were able to jump in and assist in some way. And also more generally, to fight the death penalty, internationally, just as a human rights voice. Canada's always been a voice for human rights. and also, you know, to educate within this country against ever having returned to the death penalty, which you frequently do hear when there's a disturbing crime in the country, then you get all the right-wing pundits yelling about, you know, string him up and hang him and all that stuff. So we use basically those three functions.
Wonderful. So, you know, you touched on a million things there. So, you know, let's talk about the intersections between poverty, racism, and the death penalty, because, like you say, a lot of people don't understand the connections, and you know, they're important, very important connections to make.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's an old saying that says it's not those, you know, with the worst crimes that you find on death row, but those with the worst lawyers, and that's not just a joke, but it's pretty much true. And the fact is, if you were to be accused of a crime tomorrow in the States, you better have you better own a $300,000 house to start, and be able to mortgage it just to get a lawyer to talk to you. If you're going to be dealing with legal aid, you're going to be ending up on death row with no advocates, very little in the way of. You'd be lucky if you can get your appeals lawyer to write you a letter once every 6 months, and probably ending up writing to Dave and Tracy, the Canadian Coalition Against the Death Penalty, to put your case online in hopes that some crusading lawyer somewhere will see it and help you. So that's what it comes down to. It's completely a financial issue. You do not find rich people on death row. There is not one out of nearly 4,000 prisoners in the States. It's a fallacy that you find serial killers, for example. There are a few, but most of the serial killers whose names you'd know are doing, you know, terms of 100 years or 200 years or something like that, life in prison, essentially, because they were able to get, you know, better lawyers for whatever reason, if it was a high-profile case. And a lot of the people that you'll actually find on death row, contrary to what you would think, is, you know, the 19-year-old who was all cracked out and shot someone in a local robbery, and you'd never know his name. So the reality is, the death penalty is the luck of the draw. It's where you live in the country, what prosecutor happens to get their case on, you know, on the desk, and most importantly, whether you have the financial wherewithal to fight it. So the fact that, I mean, that should say it all. There's a lot of rich people doing horrible crimes. It's not an economic issue when you come to murder, and there's not one person of any financial means on death row. There was at one time one. The only reason he was sentenced to death, and he's since been sentenced to life, was because he had killed a woman, or supposedly killed a woman, who worked in the governor's office. So in that case, obviously, influence, you know, Trump finance. So, yeah. But unfortunately, yeah, it's an economic issue.
Note to self, don't kill someone attached to the only person that can pardon you. So that's poverty, and we know that. And where does racism fill in?
Well, that comes into what part of the country, and that's a, you know, historical thing, and that's, I mean, it would take hours to really cover the whole prison industrial complex and that whole system, but essentially, it's very much like in Canada. In Canada, I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but the Native population represented in prison is way off the charts compared to the population, you know, represented in the country. And it's the same in the state. When I visited death row, we visited Jimmy Dennis in 2003 on death row in Pennsylvania, 2 days, a Saturday and a Sunday, for 8 hours in the visiting room. And the visiting rooms were full, which is about 20. Everyone's, like, closed off. You can't actually touch the prisoner or anything. You're behind glass. But there's about 20 little rooms where people can visit prisoners. And on both of those days, the rooms were full, and it was all black and Hispanic families visiting people. And one white guy on the second day finally had a, you know, just made me feel that I was in a concentration camp or something. Like, it really was a visual. I was like, whoa, like, this is like a place where this is a murder camp. They're killing people here. And they're like, all these white guards and all these, you know, black and Hispanic prisoners, and everyone's just normal. Like, it just was really striking. I'm sure it's not the regular population of prisons, you know.
What do you say when you read this Angus Reid poll that was just released, that 63% of Canadians are in favor of reinstating the death penalty?
It doesn't surprise me. Those numbers haven't fluctuated very much over the time I've done this, and even probably for 10 years before, or pretty much since the mid-90s, the numbers have been fairly along those lines. And what we always say is the quote that goes around the advocacy circles for the death penalty, and it's true, is that support for the death penalty is a mile wide and an inch deep. I think we all, when we hear these murder stories, our first instinct, obviously not being murderers or criminals, is is we relate to the victim. And, you know, obviously there was, we're going to have those sympathies, and we will react out of fear and anger, because these are some pretty terrible stories. I mean, even I, after all these years of doing this, some stories just take me aback. Not necessarily death penalty stories, but just news stories you hear about crime, and you're like, wow, there's an emotional response, and you realize that's why we, you know, people, that's why people want the death penalty, because they respond emotionally to these horrible stories. But, you know, we have to get beyond that and realize that it's not a question of what does a person deserve, but more does what do we deserve as a society? Do we deserve to be giving people the death penalty? Do we want to live in a society where Stephen Harper, for example, is signing death warrants? Because that's the reality. Stephen Harper will be the guy signing death warrants, or Dalton McGuinty, or, you know, are imperfect politicians that we don't agree with on, you know, everything else. We think they're so terrible on taxes and auto insurance and everything. Well, all of a sudden, they're going to have the wisdom of the ages and be able to decide that, you know, one person is nothing but the worst thing they've ever done. And that person has nothing good in them and needs to be executed immediately. And I can just tell you, after all these years of doing that, this, I haven't met a person like that yet. And I've, you know, even pretty bad dudes, but, you know, people are locked away, and they're in a cage, essentially, and if we're worried that they're going to cause further harm, we need to make sure that, you know, our jails are secure and safe, and there's programming inside for the humans that we put there, but we can't continue to act out. I think, you know, we respond out of fear and anger, and that's essentially what it is. I think if most Canadians understood the realities of the death penalty, those numbers would not be that high. If they really, I mean, I've known a lot of friends who said, you know, yeah, I believe in the death penalty, but when they actually look into it and study it, there's so many misconceptions that we base all the judgments on, just in the application of the death penalty. And people, you know, just general things people don't understand, like, that it's one individual prosecutor. I remember having a prosecutor tell me the story of why she had to leave the prosecutor's office, because her superior would just come in, throw five files on the desk and say, we need your death penalty case, here's five murder cases, pick one. And it was that arbitrary. And this is human life. So again, when it's, you know, the luck of the draw, whether we're executing someone, I think most Canadians are more fair-minded than that. And especially when in our own country in recent years, we've had so many wrongful convictions. You know, Guy Pomeran is only one of them, Robert Balcevich. I can name, you know, there's tons of them. Just over the last few years here in Canada, that, you know, thank all that's holy that we do not execute people, because we would all have blood on our hands.
A fair trial, what's that, right?
A trial is essentially who can tell the best story, who has the best lawyer, and who can be most convincing to those 12 people. It's when, you know, it's not, we don't actually get to any truth. We're, if we do, it's by luck. I mean, our concept of a trial and where it came from was originally in small communities where people had some idea of their players and knew each other. And now we don't know. I watch trials on TV and, you know, and I have no idea. I'm thinking, oh, the person's guilty, they're innocent, I believe them, I don't believe them. And I know just as much as the jury does. And at the end of the day, there's 12 people, and we don't have a more perfect system. I'm not saying we should change it, but at the end of the day, as far as, you know, the jury system, it's 12 people making a judgment based on the story they're told, and then you have a judge in front not even allowing them to get all the information. So they're, you know, it's not a perfect system, and we cannot execute people based on that kind of human judgment, because we do it wrong all the time. And even if we were to get it right, and we would always get in the guilty person, again, you know, we can't see into someone's heart. We don't know someone. We don't know the whys. We don't know that once someone's caged and society's protected, we don't need to be doing what that person did and lowering ourselves and you know, murdering someone who's locked in a cage and no further harm to us, just because it makes us feel better.
Yeah, you know, that brings up pictures of, you know, shooting an animal locked up in a cage just for fun.
Exactly, because, I mean, because we're angry. I mean, once they've done, well, we've caught them now. They're, you know, they're contained, it's done. And now are we not, is it not incumbent on us to be humane? Because supposedly, since we're in judgment of that person and their actions, we're better than them, because, right? Because we believe not killing, you know, they were wrong to kill. So it's, again, back to that another saying that we have, the death penalty movement, is why do we kill people who kill people to show that killing people is wrong? It's not logical. It's, again, fear and emotion-based. And that's, you know, in my opinion, that's not what we should be basing public policy on. When we say 50% are for the death penalty, again, we're, like, thinking in a childish way. It's not fair. Why should you get this if you take it this way from someone else? But it's not a matter of it being fair. It's a matter of how do we administer a humane society. You know, it's like the quote, again, a quote that says every society gets the criminals it deserves. And if we are trying to deal with our criminal problems in a manner that, you know, we were dealing with them 2,000 years ago, I mean, have we not advanced in psychology and sociology and community? And have we gained nothing in 2,000 years that all we can think of is throw a rock at them or pull a switch or, you know, we're so clever now we can do a needle so it looks prettier for us?
What do you think about the other side of this survey that says apparently that given a choice of life imprisonment without parole or the death penalty, Canada says that they would rather life in prison without parole?
Absolutely, and that's always what's followed up, you know, with the first question. Most people, when they're asked blindly, do you support the death penalty? A lot of people will say yes. If you ask them again, well, what if guaranteed life in prison without parole for those cases where that's necessary, like, you know, someone has a dangerous offender status and it's, you know, warranted. In that instance, and we could guarantee they're never going to get out and there's no further danger to anybody, in that instance, would you still want to kill them? And the vast majority of people say, oh, well, then I guess no. So I don't think we're as bloody-minded or revenge-minded in this country as, you know, America has, for example, not yet learned not to be. In their country, the victim's family members often feel cheated if they don't get the death penalty, which is a danger because the death penalty exists, even though only 2 or 3% actually get it. I mean, think of the numbers of murders in the States, and there's only 4,000 people on death row. So while that's, you know, 4,000 too many from a human rights standpoint, it's a tiny, tiny percentage of the actual murder rate. So what actually is happening is all those victims who don't get the death penalty, the victim's family members, they all feel cheated because somehow their family member wasn't worth that. If somebody can stand up there and have 20 people speak for them in court and talk about what a great person they were and how civic-minded, then the jury is going to get all riled up and give them the death penalty. And if it's, you know, for example, a homeless guy, doesn't matter how grievously he was hurt or murdered, but you don't have 20 people to stand up and give victim impact statements, then it doesn't matter. So on so many different levels, it's just, you know, disturbing the deeper you look into it. And I really think that's, you know, our role is to continue to educate Canadians so that they'll come to an understanding of what actually happens in the application of the death penalty, not just as a, you know, pie in the sky idea where it sounds fair, but that, you know, the actual human application and how disturbing it actually is when you look at it, then they'd be joining us insisting that, you know, we never, ever, ever return to it, as the Supreme Court had said back in 2000 in the Burns or Fay case, you know, regarding a couple of Canadians who were going to be extradited to the U.S. to face the death penalty. It's when they finally said, no, we no longer will ever send anyone, you know, back to a death penalty state without the receiving state promising us they won't be asking for a death sentence. So.
That it is. So what about the death penalty as a deterrent to crime?
Well, I mean, what's the biggest state that uses the death penalty the most? Texas. Do they have a better crime rate than us? I don't think so. You know, I was terrified when I was in Texas. So. There's no studies that have ever proven that it's a deterrent. Again, it's an emotional response. People will say, oh, well, it's a deterrent to that guy. He won't kill again. Well, that's funny, you know, but he also won't kill again if, you know, you imprison him in a properly run criminal justice system. And you get to the point of just, well, we just want to kill him because we're mad. And then, again, society, public policy should not be based on revenge. If it is, we have a very unhealthy society.
Constantly get the same argument. Debunk them for me.
Well, it's pretty much not even an argument. We get the what about Bernardo, which, again, we can easily say, what about the Bernardo case? In the Bernardo case, we end up having, you know, two apparently equally guilty people, Carla and Paul, accusing each other, one turning state's evidence against the other, and basically walking away with a sweetheart deal, while the other one would, in this case, go to death row. Well, which, you know, okay, so we get one down, one free. In order to get that death penalty, we've got one killer walking free, so an imperfect case to begin with. And then, secondly, Robert Belcevich, the case I referenced earlier, who was in prison for killing his girlfriend for several years, it turns out now that was probably Paul Bernardo's first murder. But, you know, she and Bernardo knew each other at the Scarborough U of T campus. There's all kinds of evidence pointing that way, and further evidence pointing that he's innocent and he's walked. And the government's, yeah, I can't remember now if he's been paid out $12 million, but his lawyers are trying to get a $12 million payout for a wrongful conviction and all those years he did in prison for killing his girlfriend, which he didn't do. So, again, in that case, we would have one wrongfully, so right around the Bernardo case, we'd have one wrongfully convicted person on death row. We'd have another guy who actually did that on death row for other crimes, and we have an equally guilty person walking around who turned state's evidence. That's great. We've got one right out of three there. So great, the Bernardo case, exactly. <You know? laughs>
Awesome, right?
So it's just one, but, and then generally it's more emotion-based about what about the little girl that gets killed or this and that, and it all comes down to, again, these are all emotional-based arguments. They'll just try to top the horrible story with the horrible story before it. And I could tell a whole bunch of bad stories, too. But it all comes down to, again, how can we teach that killing is wrong by killing people? You know, it's just ridiculous.
Anything else you want to add on this contentious issue?
Yeah, I guess just I always want to, if I can, mention the Jimmy Yettis case again, which brought us into all of this, because he is still sitting on death row, and his time is very seriously running out. He's been on death row since 1991. We got involved with the case in 1998. We managed to bring in some actual crusading lawyers, which is impossible to find, who are very good. They were looking for a case of actual, factual innocence. They've been involved since 2000, spent about $7 million on gathering more evidence. We have about three lawyers, which, again, this is something you do not get because this guy is absolutely innocent. If the state's not listening, we were still going through lawyers and lawyers, and now we're hoping to get to the federal level. But every time we get closer to that, we also get closer to potential execution, as, you know, all a judge has to do. People think an appeal is another mini trial where, you know, mistakes will get caught, and if you're innocent, you're freed. It's not the case. Usually an appeal, it's just if you can't point out a particular error in law that one person, like one particular person in the trial did, then the judge will just rubber stamp it. Nope, won't even look at it. So we've been fighting for years to get the state to look at that. The more public pressure, the better. There's a petition, which we're definitely wanting to get more numbers on, which is on jimmydennis.net. We also have jimmydennis.com. There's some German sites, so you can really just Google Jimmy Dennis. But jimmydennis.net, I would really implore people to go and sign that petition. We have 1,500 prisoners on our page at ccadp.org. It's Canadian Coalition Against the Death Penalty. You can read their pen pal requests, their writings, their case information, documentation, whatever they've sent. Basically, our organization offers free web space to anyone sentenced to death anywhere in the world. They have no access to the internet, of course. They will write us, and then we put that stuff online. So it's basically a clearinghouse of all kinds of information they would get nowhere else directly from the mouths of people sentenced to death. And I hope people will go and check it out.
The last thing, Montana case.
Right now, where that stands is the governor who's just left, we were really hoping that he would be a brave and not leave it for the incoming governor and that he would give him clemency, but it turns out he did not give him clemency. The horrible thing about that is, up to a couple of years ago, up to 2007, regardless of the fact that we had the Stephen Harper government, the bureaucrats who are in Ottawa, whether the Liberals or the Conservatives or all the people who are in power, were doing their job behind the scenes as they had for 40 years, and we have a Canadian on death row with the consulate, speaking of consulate about repatriating him to the prison here, as his co-defendant was years ago. And anyway, apparently Harper and his boys got wind of this, hadn't heard of that kind of thing, speaking out for death row prisoners before. And when they heard about it, they made a public statement that we were not going to be speaking out on behalf of our prisoner on death row in the States anymore. It's created a bit of a political whirlwind. Even the Liberal Party was caught in the Canadian Coalition. It's a death penalty at the time. Help. We ended up getting a letter from Jack Layton, a letter from Stéphane Dion for the governor of Montana, telling him that, Stephen Harper does not represent all of Canadians on this issue. Please, we would like clemency for a citizen. When the government dropped the ball, it made it more difficult for the state governor to advocate for this prisoner because there's a lot of pressure. You have them to stand there that, why should a Canadian or anybody else get any different treatment, blah, blah, blah. We'd love to kill them, blah, blah, blah. But if our government was standing up and their governor could have said this is an international issue because the fact is we have treaties, blah, 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 and he could have essentially dropped the ball and made it not difficult for him in front of voters. But because of Harper playing games, our citizen is still on death row and now at very, very serious risk of execution. I'm in touch with friends and family members. And again, such Ronald Smith and CCADP for updates. And that's a case where helping write to your MP, contact your MP, say you're really concerned. We have a Canadian citizen on death row in Montana. His co-defendant was repatriated to Canada several years ago. And in fact, Ronald would never be on death row except for the fact that at the time he felt so bad about the killing, he asked for the death penalty. And then years later, when he realized what it was doing to his family and everything, he started the fight, you know, to appeal for his life. But he would have been freed years ago if he hadn't had a conscience, felt bad, and basically told the jury to give him the death penalty. So it's another sad case.
Just another very sad case and a long list of sad cases. And I mean, that one just always rips at my soul because, you know, here's someone who's taking ownership for their actions, which, I mean, how many people do we have in the criminal justice system that are taking responsibility?
Exactly. And people think, you know, throw yourself on the mercy of the court, you know. And I don't even think he was trying to do that. Like, I think he legitimately was like, wow, you know, I can't believe I did that. So I'm not going to fight it, you know. And how arbitrary, again, it shows how arbitrary it all is. And people have the misconception, again, that it's the people with the worst crimes you're going to find on death row. They think, and even I thought when I first, you know, got involved with the death penalty, let me go and search the prisoners' names, because I had read true crime and everything else, I thought I would recognize half the names on death row. I didn't recognize any of them. It was like maybe two people, forgotten people, and not the kind of cases that you generally have in mind. Like, I never thought that, you know, not to say that it's not a serious crime, obviously, but the 18-year-old who ends up, you know, all drunkenly or cracked out, shoots somebody at the corner store, that's the death penalty case. When a guy who, you know, hunts and kills 60 women, for example, like the Green River Killer, gets a term a year. 17-year-old in Texas who had shot someone in a store robbery, and he wrote, this is before, like, now they don't sentence people under 18 to death, but this stuff's very new. When I started in 1998, they were still sentencing 17-year-olds to death. And I remember a Texan, 17-year-old Texan, wrote us and said, I know I might sound stupid, but I didn't even know we still had the death penalty. I thought that was like Old West stuff. You know, and he couldn't, and he commented on, sounds like a cliche, but he probably couldn't even buy cigarettes when they still had cigarettes in their prison, you know, commissary. He wasn't allowed to buy cigarettes because he was too young on death row. He was 17 or 18 on death row. They would not sell him cigarettes, but they were executing him. You know, is one thing that just recently, very recently changed. So we're moving forward, I guess.
Moving forward, there's still 33 states and 57 countries that condone the death penalty. In
Uganda, there's some cases we're not even talking about crime. We still have the death penalty for, you know, for being gay or for drug offenses. So, you know, people don't even realize, while we condone the death penalty, why is the UN allowing, for example, things like that? Why is the, are there any UN member states that have the death penalty for being gay or for you know, being caught with however much marijuana or something like that? It's ridiculous. This still exists in our world.
And we'll be back on Between the Margins after the break with more on the death penalty. Welcome back to Between the Margins, a show about human rights and people's pursuit of happily ever after. My name is Michelle Boyce, and in this segment, we are continuing our conversation about the death penalty. And coming up, we have June Barney, who is the sister of James Harold, who has been on Arizona's death row for 20 years, and the husband of death row prisoner Susan Atkins, who died in prison after her sentence was commuted after almost 40 years behind bars. Nothing tells us the story of these prisoners more than the families who, as the saying goes, are right there in the cell with the prisoners. And here is June Barney telling her story.
My name is June Barney. I'm the sister of James Harrod, and he was arrested and charged with murder in 1995. That's kind of what brought me into this world. That's kind of the death penalty being part of it, even knowing how it works, it exists. And all I can say about the first feelings of being involved in this was numb for years, numb, and in a state of disbelief. And since it was so high profile, the media surrounded my family, making life even more unbearable. It was on the news daily. People that we knew no longer wanted to know us. People that we worked with and for no longer trusted being around us, because this was a person in our family that we loved who had been arrested but yet had not been charged with the crime. But we were already sentenced and paying a price from the moment it hit the air.
I can't even imagine what you're going through as a family member in this. Can you talk about some of the feelings you've been through? It's been 20 years and it's still an ongoing battle, and I can't even imagine.
I don't want you to imagine, Michelle. I don't ever want you to be in this position, nor anybody on this earth to be in this position. This is a state that we are in that cell with him. The family is just as much a prisoner and is ostracized as much as the person that is behind that cell. For 20 years, I personally, just me personally, I've lived, eat, breathe my brother. I've spoke to papers. I've gone to Canada and met with the Innocence Project, Reuben Hurricane Carter and his committee. I've talked to numerous attorneys. I've sent letters asking, begging people to become involved, to take a second look, because everything was just so wrong from the beginning. It overtook my life to a point of where I had graduated from college in May of 95. He was arrested in September of 95. In December of 95, I'm laying in a bed weighing 72 pounds and wondering if I'm going to be able to stand up to walk, and if I do, if I'm going to go in that next room and try to kill myself again, because I couldn't take it. I couldn't watch what was happening to him. I couldn't watch what was happening to my mother.
You said your mom's not with you with us anymore, but...
Right, she passed away. I'm a mother. I know what it's like when your child hurts. Anybody that's a mother can empathize with when your child hurts, you hurt. But I don't know if anybody can empathize with the pain that a mother must go through to walk through metal detectors with pulling an oxygen tank behind them, barely able to walk, and then go through more metal gates, be searched, then go into a room, and not to be able to touch or feel your loved one because they're behind a piece of plexiglass. And she hadn't touched him from the day of his arrest and even upon her death. He was there. She was here. There was no closure. I mean, for her, there was no closure. She lived her life as well for that everyday letter from him. She was his link to the outside world and his encouragement. He holds stronger than I do at this point. Upon our visit just yesterday, he's encouraging me to stay strong while I'm looking at him and going, how can you do this? And he said, I know one day I'm going to be free. This truth is going to come out. How? I don't know. Somebody was going to listen. It will happen. I'm going to come home. He has in his heart that absolute belief that the right thing will be done. And it's people like yourself, Tracy, Dave, other people that will make the difference to let the world see that what they're doing by killing, and that's what they're doing, they're killing people, is wrong on every level, because it's wrong to kill anybody. If it's wrong to kill anybody on the outside, why would it be right to kill somebody on the inside? You know, living there every day, day in and day out, that's worse than death. It truly is. Those gentlemen are of a state of mind of where death is welcome because it's easier than the life they're living now. And that's a horrible thought to have to walk away and know that you're going into the comfort of your car to go to a place to eat maybe or to your home where when they take your loved one back to a 8x10 cement cell with no windows, no view to the outside. They can't even see other prisoners. They're totally isolated. Totally isolated. They don't even have recreation together. They do not have food together. They are all suffering from RES, reduced environmental stimuli. They have none, nothing, and nobody cares. They're not even treated as humans. That's the sad part.
So tell me a little bit about your brother's case. You know, basically, as I understand it, he didn't know the victim in any way. I mean, I'm getting the Coles Notes version here, and maybe you can shed just a little bit of light on things.
I will try definitely to shed a little bit of light on it. He did not know the victim. He did know the victim's stepson. As far as the case in and of itself, of course, it's on his website, jameshara.net, a lot of the information, including his recent appeal. But what the case happened in 1988, a woman who lived in an exclusive, gated, guarded community with security in her home was shot and killed. In 1995, they arrested my brother and they charged him in that crime of knowing who killed her and not giving information to the police about this. They wanted number one, number two, number three. These were her stepchildren. And if they had something to do with the crime, that will forever be a mystery to everybody because the young man that they wanted passed away 7 months ago. The person they focused this whole trial on and brought his name up through the entire trial but was not allowed to testify is now gone. But in this mother's case was sent to the United States Supreme Court under the Ring decision, which is Timothy Ring of Arizona, under the Apprendi decision out of New Jersey, which then brought him back into a courtroom where they again put him on trial for the second time for his life. But this new jury was not allowed to be informed of any of the information that the first jury had. They were told he was guilty. They were to decide if he lived or died, but they were given no information as to the crime, how it occurred, when it occurred, what his possible involvement in the crime could have been. And this time, they upped the ante. He was the actual shooter. They changed the theory from their original trial. The jury came back with so many questions, all relating to what happened, what happened. How did this happen? And he, again, was found guilty based upon what was presented. The woman who was killed, as I stated, lived behind a gated community in a home that had a security system. Whoever killed this woman, but whoever got through to get to her had to have been somebody other than my brother. And the only reason I'm going to say it, and I hope this makes your listeners laugh, the ass doesn't fit, you must acquit. Because the window was 22 inches wide, and my brother weighed 350 pounds. There's no physical way he could have made it through the window. Even the jury understood that. They looked at him. They looked at the window. They all agreed with that fact. But that's supposedly what happened. He gained entry through that 22-inch by 24-inch window and let the killers in to kill her.
What will save your brother's life?
You know, Michelle, I truly do not have an answer to what would, what could save my brother's life would be the learned men that sit and judge and read the papers with the actual facts and come to the conclusion after reading the paperwork, the facts, that this person is not where they're supposed to be, that they did not have an involvement in this, or their involvement in any crime would not necessitate the death penalty. Where do I see us right now? What do I feel right now? I'm going to use the word, and I told you I wouldn't, but I feel so extremely hopeful that the gentleman that wrote this, Richard Gerloff, he's the absolutely the most amazing attorney. There is not a fact that man misses. And I'm hoping that the facts that he managed to pull out that were truth and produce to the judges to read, when they read it, fresh eyes that have never seen this case for themselves. They've heard about it and the rulings in it, but they've not had part in it, especially if it goes higher. They will look at it and they will say, something's wrong here. And when they say that something's wrong, a lot of things are wrong. It's very difficult, although it wasn't a science when he did it. Today, it's considered in Arizona a science to pass a polygraph exam, which he did successfully several times, twice, meaning several. And he did that at the request of the prosecution with the understanding it would be entered before the jury. It never was. Again, he passed it. I'm not pointing fingers. The stepdaughter failed. That's on his website. I didn't get the polygraph. I didn't make the results. They're there for anyone to read. And it's just a shame. A lot of people in the field of law don't really read the facts. And our state, our... And I understand this might be going on in other countries where there are laws that if you do something, you get X amount of time, flat time. There's no leniency, and the judge doesn't have any discretion to rule. The judge in this case did a directed verdict. A directed verdict means he knew what verdict he was going to give. And so far in advance, Michelle, that I knew, and it's in a newspaper recorded within 1 week that my brother was getting the death penalty. Now, we're talking 1 week after his arrest. How can you know that? How can anyone know that? He hadn't even been in a courtroom. The judge had already made up his mind. Something's wrong here, Michelle.
I hear you, June. And my heart goes out to you and your family and your brother, and hopefully we can shed a little bit of light on the subject, and maybe you can tell the listeners the website where they can get more information and where they can get involved.
I would be more than happy. Thank you. Thank you, Michelle. The website is jamesharrod.net.
Thanks, June, for your story. And next up is James Whitehouse, and this is his story. Can you introduce yourself, James?
Okay, my name is James Whitehouse, and I married Susan Atkins in 1987, 17, 18 years after she was arrested as part of the one of the defendants in the Manson crimes, and she was found guilty and sentenced to death in 1971, I believe, and in 1972, California overturned the death penalty, and her sentence was commuted to 7 to life. She stayed in prison for 40 years. She passed away about 3 years ago, and I guess it's 4 years ago now, in 2009, at which point she was the longest-serving woman prisoner in United States history.
And from what I read about her, she accomplished a lot while behind bars.
That's what I found out. I actually met her because, you know, 30 years ago, whenever I was using a lot of drugs, and I was at a point in my life where I was, you know, realized I wanted to get away from that. I wasn't even enjoying it. It was expensive and dangerous and bad for my health. And I happened to just by accident hear this story about this woman who changed her life around on death row. And I thought, you know what, if she can do that on death row, I don't have any excuses. And because it was a struggle, I think I was 22 at the time, living, you know, with some young friends. It wasn't a great environment for change. I wrote her, and she wrote back, and we corresponded for about a year where she encouraged me as I slowly gave up hard drugs and then heavy drinking and then partying all together. And as I got to know her, I was just amazed at the amount of work that I discovered that life, her and the other life inmates of it, you know, our prison out here did for the state. And I asked her, well, why, you know, they never say this on TV. Why doesn't anyone ever say this? And she said, well, that doesn't tell ad space. They don't want the public to know this stuff. And the more I got to know her, the more I realized just the incredible work that she did, helping other people. And it really gave me an appreciation for the fact that we're all in this community. We're all interwoven. And even though you think that people in prison are out of sight and out of mind, they have an impact on us. And one of the huge impacts they have are that the lifers and the only remaining rehabilitation programs were mostly things that the lifers ran for the short-termers. So you end up with young women, you know, get in trouble. They have to do 6 months or 4 months or a year in prison. And for you and me, whether or not they spend that, how they spend those 6 months is very important. You know, whether or not they're going to come out, become part of our community again and contribute, or whether they're just going to start a cycle of going back.
And if the state had murdered her in 1972, none of that would have happened.
The death penalty has never been a deterrent. You know, in the United States, we had it up until 1972. Then the U.S. Supreme Court declared it was unconstitutional as they were imposing it. And for 3 years, we didn't have it. And in 1975, we got it back. So we have all the statistics. The crime rate didn't change at all. You know, it's not a deterrent, and then you find out that it's extremely expensive. It's more expensive than keeping someone in prison for the rest of their life. On top of that, like I said, they don't participate as much in the community. They don't pay back. They don't help out the short-termers. They don't contribute to trying to rehabilitate other people. These costs just slowly build up and up. And what's even more ironic is that the death penalty itself, not only is it not a deterrent, but you end up creating a culture where it's okay to kill people. In the United States, we have a government that if they don't like what other countries are doing, they kill people. And if they don't like what our citizens are doing, they kill them. And so we grow up in a culture where our own government tells us, you know, in certain circumstances, it's okay to kill people if you really don't like them or you don't like what they did. And then, of course, we've got this horrible problem with inner city kids growing up in gangs and stuff, and these same politicians say, well, golly, why don't these young people just talk it out? Which is idiotic. Well, that's the reason they don't talk it out is because that's not what they're taught. You know, they're taught that no, this is an appropriate way of dealing with problems. You kill people.
So you married Susan in prison. Obviously, you
felt
very strongly about her. And how did your life change, and how did it turn around?
And that was a story I usually tell people because I knew her for about 2 years before I married her, and for a lot of people, I understand it's hard to say, well, wait, how did you get past the, even if you're impressed with her, how did you get past the, you know, the social stigma because everybody knows who she was? And there's one story that sticks in my mind, and I was talking to her one time. And up at the prison, they had a walk-a-thon once a year. And I don't remember if it was around Halloween or something. And the women would, you know, get people to contribute, you know, a dime for every third of a mile they walked or something. And they raised money, and the money that they raised was given to the sheriff's department to buy toys, which the sheriff's department gave out to homeless children. And the women up there, you know, did this every year. Susan watched something like 18 miles. And then the sheriffs would get this money, and they'd buy these toys, and then they'd give them out to homeless children. And every year, the sheriffs would be shown on TV and in the newspapers handing out these toys, and they'd be heroes. And never once did the sheriff's bother to say, oh, yeah, by the way, this money came from the women in the women's prison over here. And I got kind of mad about that, and I told Susan, you know, when they were getting ready for it, I told her, you know, don't do that. That's stupid. You know, I'm going to contribute to that. And, you know, it just made me mad. I said, you know, if the sheriff's department's, because on top of that, the sheriff's department then went to Sacramento and lobbied for every ridiculous, you know, repressive, vengeful law to make prison more difficult. And I said, the heck with them. If they want that money, let them get out there and walk 18 miles. And I was pretty young. And, you know, I just went on. And she let me, you know, vent for a while. And finally, when I was done, Susan said, yes, but you're missing something. And I said, what? What am I missing? And Susan said, if we don't do this, those kids aren't going to get any toys. In that moment, I realized that Susan already knew this. I mean, she knew how the sheriffs were using this, and she knew all that. But she knew that there was something more important. And that just said so much about how I came to understand her. That she wasn't foolish, and she knew the public perception and stuff, and yet she wasn't going to stop contributing, and she wasn't going to stop trying to help people. And at 22, I just overdosed the second time, and I realized after that, it was rather sobering, because I realized, you know, if I had died, nobody would have cared at that point in my life. I'd alienated everyone, and I suddenly, when I came out of that, I said, you know what, if you're lucky enough to live 80 years, that's not a lot of time to really contribute to the world. And I'd like to think that when I died, I'd leave something. It doesn't have to be a lot, but, you know, and when you're that age, there's not a lot that you can, ways that you can give back. And, you know, I found this woman who, even though nothing she did was acknowledged by society, she just refused to stop giving back, and I just thought that was so incredible. And I wanted to be a part of that, and I realized that she had inspired me to change my life around, and I wanted her to be a part of my life. But after I married her, you know, I was back in college. I ended up getting a scholarship to the University of California, and I graduated there with degrees in chemistry and biology, doing molecular biology, summa cum laude. And then I went on to get accepted to Harvard Law School, where I graduated with honors there. And I thought it was ironic. At Susan's last parole hearing, the parole member said, well, she's still in danger because she can still influence other people. And I thought that was funny because Charles Manson took a group of young people who had nothing going for them and led them to death row. And Susan took me at a time in my life where I had nothing going for me, and I ended up graduating from the University of California with honors and going on to Harvard Law School. I think the fact that you can influence people doesn't make you dangerous. I think it's what you do with that. And I think that Susan just really made it her part in life to encourage people to take what they had and work with that. And to that extent, when she got sick, when she was in the hospital, she just got thousands of letters, handwritten letters from people. And while she was in the hospital, I sat with her and I read all these letters, and they were just incredible, from people that she had met, you know, 30 years ago, and just writing to thank her and said, you probably don't remember me, but, you know, I met you in prison in 1978, and, you know, after I talked to you, I got out of that bad relationship, I quit drugs, I got cleaned up. And it was just incredible how many people's lives she touched, and I'm not really sure that she even really picked up on that, but it was really validating in the end to see so many people coming out.
When you can make those connections in prisons at the right moment in somebody's life, they can they can make a world of difference forever.
Yeah, and you know, for every person that gets out and never goes back, it saves society money, but much more than that, it puts them back out into the community where they're contributing. And it's a funny system up there. It works really well because if you've got a young person in their late teens or 20s, and if they're anything like I was back then, they know everything. And sometimes if they run into someone like Susan, who, you know, I've been here for 25 years, sometimes the weight of that just really hits a young person long enough that they, you know, reflect a little bit and say, okay, this is serious. This isn't a game. I don't want to, you know, come back here with a life sentence. And sometimes it gets them to, you know, shut up long enough that someone can talk to them and get them to reassess what they're doing. We realize as a community, we want people to go into prison and change their lives so they can come back out. We want people in prison as short as possible to still have a deterrent effect, and then to get them back into the community as participating, contributing members as quick as possible. But we turn this system over to a group of people whose interests are exactly the opposite. The Prison Guards Union does not want people coming out of prison. They don't want people in for a short amount of time. They want them in as long as possible. And they don't want them to have any rehabilitation. They want them to come right back. And then we act surprised when it doesn't work.
Anything you'd like to say to Canadians that are thinking this is a great idea?
Well, it's just, I know it's an emotive issue, and you know that the state or the district attorneys down here who want to promote this idea, all they have to do is wait for one egregious crime, and then they make a big, you know, TV campaign out of it. And it is an emotive issue, which means if you're not careful, people will use your emotions to get you to ignore the facts. And the truth is that it's not a deterrent. Second of all, quite frankly, it does not make the victims' families healthier. It does not help them heal. It does not make them feel better. It actually deteriorates the sanctity of human life in your culture. It's expensive, and you end up inevitably running the risk of killing innocent people. So no, I obviously don't believe in it. There's no real facts to back it up. And so what you're really talking to are people who are healing from a purely emotional dam.
You've been listening to Between the Margins on CHRW 94.9 FM. My name's Michelle Boyce, and you can catch our previous shows at www.betweenthemargins.ca. We hope that you have your happily ever after, whatever that may look like to you.